Is he here?
Yeah, there he is.
Which one is it? First one up?
First two.
First two.
Working all these?
34 and 89.
89?
34 and
89? 31-89? Okay. Ron? Welcome to the April 26, 2011 Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We're going to start off with opening a public hearing on, we'll actually open on both of them, Representative, give you a chance here. So we'll open on House Bill 3334 and 3189. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Jim Widener, represent Yamhill County and a little bit of Polk County. And the first bill I will talk to you about is House Bill 3189.
Did you bring samples?
I did not bring samples. Oh, however, if you were House members, you would have received samples on House Bill 3189 because this came about.
What can I say?
I guess we could call Mrs. Perch and ask her what she thinks about that. So, but if you ever head up to McMinnville or in the McMinnville area, just off of 3rd Street next to the Oregon Hotel or Hotel Oregon, there is a small bakery called the Red Fox Bakery that makes incredible macaroons, or also known as a cookie. So, House Bill 3189 originated with a constituent call on April 7th, 2010 from Lori Furch, owner of the Red Fox Bakery in McMinnville. She had called to ask for help after an Oregon food inspector had notified her that she did not have a proper license to sell cookies at her bakery. He explained that technically the law requires an additional license for $450 a year if she's going to continue to sell cookies at her bakery under Oregon law. Of course, after 11 years of owning her and operating her bakery and never been told this previously about the additional license, she was a little confused. This is how we got into contact with Vance Bybee, Director of the Food Safety Division of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. House Bill 3189 will remove undue regulation and allow for greater freedom for Oregon bakeries to operate and flourish by allowing a bakery to operate under a single license. We have expanded the definition of bakery product to include the sale of cookies. This small change under ORS 625.010 is fully supported by the Food Safety Division of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. This bill passed the House Committee of Business and Labor unanimously and continued to gather support as it passed the House floor. If you need cookies, I think that would kind of be legal if we brought you cookies. I guess it's under $50, so you'd probably be okay eating these cookies. Other bakeries that would fall into Great Harvest, places like that, they actually make cookies in those, and they are not being charged this fee or have not been paying this fee. So basically, we're cleaning up the books for the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
All righty, while you're there, you want to do 3334 as well?
I will go ahead. Once again, State Representative Jim Widener, and I represent Yamhill County, and now I will testify on House Bill 3334. While investigating into House Bill 3189, I continued working relationship with Vance Bybee, Director of the Food Safety Division. Under ORS 625.215, it says, it shall be unlawful for any person to manufacture, bake, sell, or offer for sale for human consumption any of the breads, rolls, buns specified under ORS 625.212 unless they are enriched. We are simply looking to exempt from mandatory vitamin enrichment those breads and bread products that derive from whole grain. This would ensure that the bread product derived from whole grain would contain the vitamins that naturally occur in whole grain bread and would not include those vitamins that do not naturally occur in whole grain bread. If passed, organic and natural bakeries could now sell bread in natural and nutritious state without artificial presence of mandatory vitamins enriched if derived from whole grain. This bill is approved by the Food Safety Division of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. This bill is in line with federal law and the FDA under Section 2 of the Federal Standard of Identity of Bread relating to whole grain bread products. where there is no prohibition to allow sales of whole grain natural bread, this bill, upon passage, would allow Oregonians personal freedom to purchase bread products based on their own dietary needs. Thank you again for your time and consideration in the matter, and I encourage and appreciate your support of House Bill 3334. And the mandatory enrichment actually came during the Great Depression. We started mandating that we enrich bread at that time, and we never removed that mandate because lots of people, that's all they had to eat was bread. So we're just removing that. It's been in force forever.
The Wonder Bread generation.
Yes, Wonder Bread will still continue to wonder if it's bread.
Questions to the representative?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Brody.
I once kept a loaf of Wonder Bread alive in the refrigerator for 3 months. So I don't know what else is in it.
Have it on a leash.
But I just wanted to thank the representative for especially the second bill, because the reason whole grain doesn't have to be enriched is because it already is enriched, and that's why it doesn't need further enrichment.
Thank you, Betty Crocker.
I have a question.
Senator Atkinson.
Senator Edwards wanted to ask for his constituents with cards, would you be open to a friendly amendment for enriched brownies?
You know, if they came in plastic bags.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who... Thank you, Representative. Is there anybody else here who wishes to testify on this? I have no one signed up. Seeing none, we will open a work session on Senate Bill. We'll start off with House Bill. Excuse me, we're on the new week. House Bill 3334. The chair moves House Bill 3334 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion. No discussion. Is there any opposition? There's no opposition. House Bill 3334 is moved to the House, to the Senate floor with the do pass. We'll now open a work session on House Bill 3189. Chair moves House Bill 3189 to the Senate floor with the do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? There's no discussion. Is there any opposition? There's no opposition. House Bill 3189 is moved to the Senate floor with the do pass recommendation. Senator Girard wanted to carry these, I think.
Oh, my God.
Cut that down. The bread man. You got a twofer, Gerard. We'll close the, I don't think I closed the work site or the public hearing on those two, so we'll do that, and we'll open on House Bill 2240. Richard.
2240 removes the sunset on the provision that allow tipped restaurant workers to voluntarily waive their meal period and that prohibit an employer from coercing such employees to waive their meal period. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact on this measure.
Mr. Perry.
I
think
you did that on
tape. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on 2240. Came out of the House unanimously. This was a effort we worked on collaboratively with Labor Commissioner Gardner a few years back. And basically, those of you where you're all employees are required to take a half-hour meal period, and you're supposed to get it as close to the middle of the time period as possible. When you talk to servers, they get a majority of their income directly from the customer, and they also get it usually in the middle of their shift. So you're pulling servers off the floor at their highest revenue-generating time. And so there were several hundred servers that actually wrote to the labor commissioner at the time asking them if there was any way that they could voluntarily waive their meal period for that specific reason of them getting money from the customer and not the employer. And so because of the response, he decided that he was willing to do a test project and we would come back. And the program has been very, very, very successful. successful from our employers, employee standpoint and employer standpoint, because generally it was hard to keep the servers off the floor for the half hour when they knew the money was on the floor, so it created a conflict between the employer and the employee. So we would, we've been working with Bolio over the summer to just see if we could remove the sunset. So that was the purpose of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Super. Any questions? Kate?
All right. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I would just echo everything that Mr. Perry has said, although I did not work at the Bureau of Labor and Industries in 2007. I do remember the legislation going through. I also had a stint of being a server myself and very much believe that to be the case. What I would say from the perspective of the Bureau is we believe that during the period that this has been on the books, it has worked really well. We believe that the provisions that are in place currently, one of the a server has to voluntarily waive their meal periods, and one of the pieces that we prescribed in rule is that they have to do that attestation on a form prescribed by Bolio that sort of runs through what the provisions of the law are. And we believe that that form and the law have been working really well and are fully supportive of removing the sunset and allowing this provision to continue. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes or any questions in this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. That's all I have signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2240? We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2240. The chair moves House Bill 2240 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
I love this committee.
No discussion? I thought I heard some from out there on the other side.
No, no discussion.
Okay. Is there any opposition? There's no opposition. House Bill 2240 is passed to the House floor with a, Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Senator Starr, would you let us carry this?
Of course.
Senator Starr will carry. It goes on 2240.
You can't trade bread.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2070. Richard.
Senate Bill 2070 clarifies that the Oregon Business Development Commission presents a budget proposal to the governor, not to the Infrastructure Finance Authority. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Is there any impact? That's Lynn.
It's Lynn.
Lynn.
This is an easy committee to testify in front of.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Chesler with the Business Development Department. Yes, this is a friendly committee. Yes, I appreciate that. Some of you may recall that in the 2009 legislative session, the former Economic and Community Development Department was reorganized, now named the Oregon Business Development Department. A part of that legislation created the Infrastructure Finance Authority within the Business Development Department with its own constituent board to set policy for the IFA programs, which are essentially community development programs. That board is comprised of representatives of municipal organizations, finance and economic development representation, and essentially experts throughout the state with firsthand knowledge of community development, infrastructure development. That reorganization that did occur also retained the Business Development Commission as the governing body for the department as a whole. House Bill 2152 in the 2009 session broadly defined the relationship between the IFA board and the commission. However, during the course of development of a substantial policy document by the IFA, that being the statewide ports strategic plan, the relationship and approval authority of the board versus the commission was called into question. The matter was resolved amiably through exploration of the explicit statute language, but it was clear that there was a need for clarification of the working relationships as was identified. Also, the question surfaced regarding the board and commission roles during the development of our agency request budget. Current IFA statutes do not reflect how agency budgets are developed or the route of submission of those requested budgets, so that's a change within the statute as well that reflects the actual process that occurs today between the Administrative Services Department and the Commission's endorsement role. House Bill 2070 creates in statute the obligations for the working relationship between the IFA Board and the Business Development Commission. to assure perpetuation of the board and commission engagement as has currently been worked out, and to meet the obligation to keep each other apprised, the statute change that's reflected in 2070 is proposed. The relationship is defined as straightforward. The IFA board determines the policies and procedures for the IFA and its programs as originally envisioned by the statute. The commission, as policy-making body for the broader influence of the department as a whole, must provide the opportunity to comment and provide direction on matters relating to the infrastructure and public works programs. Practically, what occurs is I provide a report at each commission meeting regarding the considerations and actions of the IFA board, and similarly, if the commission provides any guidance or comment on the IFA's work, I report back to the IFA board, and they pursue those interests. Periodically, additionally, the IFA board chair meets with the commission to ensure that the open communication is maintained. We do not find that the bill has a fiscal impact, and if you have any questions, I'd be pleased to respond to them.
Lynn, I'm trying to... Our staff measure summary says that it clarifies the Development Commission presents a budget proposal to the governor, not the Infrastructure Finance Authority. And I'm trying to tie that into the language. Where does it say that in the bill?
If you look at the House bill, first page, line 18 and 19, the deleted language.
Right.
The recommendation is the authority submits the budget to the director and to the governor. That's not how the process works. So what's corrected in the language is the language. Let me find the place where it is reflected. I don't see it immediately, so I guess it's silent on the process that is carried out. We receive a request from the Department of Administrative Services. We follow up on that in preparing the budget. That is reviewed and ultimately endorsed by our commission as it's forwarded then to be placed in the process of creating the governor's recommended budget.
Questions? Senator Girard?
I'm just trying to read between the lines here, and I'm going to summarize the Girard way of summarizing things. There was a conflict between Oregon Business Development Commission and the OIFA. You came to an agreement. My question is simple. Why do we need to put it in statute if you have an agreement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I think it's a precautionary measure that as time and staffing changes, we want to make sure that in the future, different individuals will continue to conduct themselves in the amiable way that we've worked out at present.
Issue with the way the bill's written, but it doesn't directly address the budget as this says.
I'd have to go look at my original notes on that to see what I'm doing.
Further questions?
No, sir.
Lynn on this?
Let's see what goes
on. You okay? Okay. Thank you, Lynn. That's all I have who wanted to testify on this. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 2070? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2070.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2070 forward to best
report. Senator Atkinson moves House Bill 2070 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
No, I'm not going to discuss.
Okay. No discussion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 2070 is passed to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation by unanimous approval of the committee. Close on that. Senator Atkinson would like to carry this one, I believe.
You're in good hands.
You can find the hidden budget language.
Mm-hmm. We'll open
that public hearing on House Bill 2254.
2254 clarifies that a business entity can file an application to convert into another business. There is also a -1 amendment that I received that I have not yet received a fiscal or revenue impact on, but on the original bill there was minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Peter?
Welcome. Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office. Here to talk to you today about House Bill 2254. The bill makes a number of technical changes to Oregon business law, removing barriers that prevent the adoption of more streamlined business processes. It's part of the Secretary's effort to make it easier to do business in Oregon, and each of the changes was either suggested by or inspired by a business that ran into difficulty with the current law. Some of these issues happen all the time. Some of them only occur rarely or occasionally. First, we want to make it easy for a business to update their registration at any time. Banks, suppliers, government agencies all require or often require that a business will list its officers and directors in our business filings before they'll allow them to open accounts. Under current law, you can report that information in your articles of incorporation when you first file with us. But the way the law is worded, you then run into difficulty, and we have to use more of a workaround to allow you to update that information before your first annual report is due. After the first annual report is filed, it's a simple form. We're trying to correct the scenario where during that first year we have to require an amended articles of incorporation to get that information listed in our records. That requires extra time, effort for the business. Corporations have to go back to their board, have to go back to their directors. They have to readopt the articles in order to come back and file it with us when we think that we should just be able to take a simple form and let them get through the process quickly and easily. We want to replace standard industrial classification codes requirement with just a simple text description of the business activity. Everybody can describe what their business is in their own words, but having to go to tables, the internet, to look up how you're classified as a business or in a classification code is a little bit more onerous, frustrating, a little bit more difficult.
Let me ask you a question, Peter. By using the SIC codes, doesn't that allow you or others who might want to look to aggregate them in some way? And without those, you wouldn't really have a mechanism to do that.
Chair Beyer, in the old days, we wouldn't have a way to do that. But with the advent of search engine technology, we can find anything. We can aggregate data. We can put things together by keywords. So, advances in technology have really solved that problem, and we think we'd like to be able to adopt that and simplify that for business. We want to improve the law for a business that's coming into or going out of Oregon. As an example, a Delaware corporation cannot convert directly into an Oregon corporation. The law requires that they become something else first. So they can become an Oregon limited liability company and then convert to an Oregon corporation, but they can't get there directly. We've run into a couple of examples. Oregon corporation started here, but they organized in Delaware under the advice of their attorney. After a few years, they realized there's no advantage for them to be a Delaware corporation. They wanted to come home. The law requires that they jump through extra hoops, they didn't want to be an LLC. They wanted to be a corporation. But in order to get there, you have to go through a lot of extra paperwork, and it's really just an unfortunate choice of words in the law. So when an Oregon corporation wants to merge with a company in another state, the law forces them to requalify as an Oregon corporation on the way out the door, even if they don't plan to be here. So it's another piece of paperwork that they have to file with our office in order to get the transaction completed, and then they have to turn around and do a cancellation. So something that my office has to apologize for occasionally when this happens. It just seems silly that the law requires that. We think that can be cleaned up. When companies like Google, Sun World, or Amy's Kitchen wanted to open facilities in Oregon and bring jobs here, they first had to go to their own Secretary of State and obtain a certificate of existence. Often this is something that you have to pay $10 or $50 for, but most often you might have to wait a period of weeks. In California, it takes time to get what you need, and the law doesn't allow us to just simply go on to the California website and verify that company is in existence. My staff could do that in a few clicks of a mouse, and we'd be able to open up the door for companies to come in here and be quicker and not make them, you know, jump through some of the other hoops. We're still able to verify that they're a valid company, but we think we can use the internet to help facilitate that. We want to allow assumed business names to be able to reactivate their business name or change their business name. Currently, a corporation, LLC, they can change their name, they can reactivate or reinstate after they've gone inactive. With assumed business names, you can't do that. A lot of our small businesses in Oregon, they use the registration system to document that they're a business. And so there's a difference between a business that's been on the record for 20 years and one that's been on the record for 2 months. It's very easy to lose sight of the paperwork. When it comes from our office, you miss the deadline, you're out of luck. You have to file a new business name, and it looks like a brand new business. It's a little bit misleading for the business owner. It's misleading for the public because you can't look and tell which one is the one that's been around for a while. One of the other things that causes problem, the Construction Contractors Board. If you use an assumed business name and you get your contractor's license, they and the name goes inactive, you have to relicense as a new contractor. You can't reinstate the existing license at CCB. If you're a corporation, you could just reinstate the corporation and carry on about your business with construction contractors. So we'd like to be able to offer that same functionality to our smallest businesses, and that's what that part of the law change would do. After we got out of the House, we had some conversations with Senator Telfer, and she asked if we would be willing to work with her on an amendment, and we agreed. We thought it was a good idea. And basically, in 2009, we were able to get Oregon nonprofit law updated to allow a nonprofit, or to allow the Secretary of State to waive the 5-year limit on reinstatement for nonprofits in certain situations. At the time, that was an experiment. We think over the last 2 years, it's worked pretty well for the nonprofits that need to be able to do that. And basically, the request for Senator Telfer's office was that we expand that out to the for-profit business community simplify that process so that business that, again, just missed its paperwork and missed it for a period of 5 years, they still have an opportunity to come back and rectify that. So we agree. We think that's a good solution to the problem that some businesses are having, and we would ask for your support on the Dash 1 as well. So overall, we think this is just really a cleanup bill, that the legislature would have written the law this way if we were starting out fresh today. So I would just ask for your support. Help us to take advantage of the technologies that are currently available today and simplify things for the business community.
Questions? Got off easy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator, would you like to testify?
If I might be joined.
Absolutely.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Chris Telfer, Senator from District 27, also known as Sunny Central Oregon, although it's pretty sunny here today. I am a certified public accountant, not an attorney, so I am here merely not to practice law, but to introduce Kevin Kyler, who actually brought the issue to my office. Kevin is an attorney and can speak to this. So I'm thankful that you're hearing this, I think, needed fix.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Kyler. I'm an attorney in Bend, Oregon, and thank you so much for introducing me. Part of my practice includes representing nonprofits and public corporations that are involved in low-income housing tax credit projects, and that involves financing through the tax credit provided in the Internal Revenue Code, and it allows these entities, not generally nonprofit corporations, occasionally housing authorities, well, I guess often housing authorities as well, to form partnerships and build rent-restricted housing units and finance them by, in essence, selling tax credits to an investment limited partner or LLC member. So you have an investor, and then you have a nonprofit or housing authority general partner that runs the show. And I had been out of that that kind of work for several years while I was in-house counsel for a telecom company. And when I came back a few years ago, I started working on these projects that were at the end of the 15-year compliance period for the tax credits. So what was happening was the investors were exiting the partnerships after 15 years of successful operation of, and construction of these affordable housing projects. And as I started to help my clients in connection with the exit of the investor and where the nonprofit or housing authority would end up owning the whole thing, I started to discover that these partnerships that were formed to own these projects had been administratively dissolved, sometimes a few years back, sometimes several years back. But it wasn't an isolated instance. Of the four projects that I'm working on right now, all four of them have somebody in the group that's been administratively dissolved. One has both the project partnership and the investor limited partnership that was administratively dissolved. And what happened in every case was whoever was getting the notice of renewal had moved. And just, you know, due to timing and forwarding limitations or whatever, they did not receive the notice. In a few cases, it was the nonprofit that had moved offices. In one case, it was the attorney who was getting it that had moved offices. But these things sit around for 15 years with really no corporate, you know, they just run the apartment complex, and they're in the business of providing housing, and so I thought, boy, if I'm seeing, you know, 100% of these projects have had this problem, I think it's probably a bigger problem out there. And so I contacted my senator, Senator Telfer, and said, you know, I know they did this for the nonprofit corporations last year and allowed them to come in and prove that they've been an ongoing business entity. They filed their, you know, their tax returns. They've continued to conduct business, and that should be extended to these types of entities. They're typically limited partnerships and limited liability corporations, but also that this is probably a problem that could affect any small business out there that may have missed it and gone unnoticed for more than 5 years. The problem for the entity when it goes inactive and can't be reinstated is you have an investor who's now subject to unlimited liability, and that gives them great concern. You have a lender who has a loan against it, and probably it's an event of default under the loan documents to have been administrated, or generally would be, to have been administratively dissolved. And you may have other forms of subsidies and different contractual relationships that would potentially be breached by becoming administratively dissolved. So this would save these entities and probably a lot of small businesses a lot of headache and a lot of expense in trying to satisfy all their partners that are out there that they do business with, that they've fixed the problem by reinstating. And I support the entire bill as discussed by Mr. Threlkell, and ask for your support of the bill and Amendment Dash 1. Thank you.
Questions? Easy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on this bill? Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2254 and open the work session.
You don't have
I can't, because I don't have a fiscal.
You can adopt the amendment, but we couldn't.
But you can't without the fiscal.
What? Let's go ahead and adopt it.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 1 amendment.
Senator Atkinson has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2254. Discussion on the motion.
We have to start everything over again.
Seeing none, is there any opposition to adopting the amendment? There is none. The Dash 1s to House Bill 2254 is adopted, and we have to close today because we don't have the fiscal on it. So we'll close work session. Is there anything else to come before the committee? There's not. We're closed.